Chapter 3. At sunset, glancing up, Juliana Frink saw the dot of light in the sky shoot in an arc, disappear to the west. One of those Nazi rocket ships, she said to herself, flying to the coast, full of big shots. And here I am, down below. She waved, although the rocket ship, of course, had already gone. Shadows advancing from the Rockies, blue peaks turning to night. A flock of slow birds, migratory, made their way parallel with the mountains. Here and there a car turned its headlights on. She saw the twin dots along the highway. Lights, too, of a gas station. Houses. For months now she had been living here in Cannon City, Colorado. She was a judo instructor. Her workday had ended, and she was preparing to take a shower. She felt tired. All the showers were in use by customers of Ray's gym, so she had been standing, waiting outdoors in the coolness, enjoying the smell of mountain air, the quiet. All she heard now was the faint murmur from the hamburger stand down the road by the highway's edge. Two huge diesel trucks had parked, and the drivers, in the gloom, could be seen moving about, putting on their leather jackets before entering the hamburger stand. She thought, didn't Diesel throw himself out the window of this stateroom? Commit suicide by drowning himself on an ocean voyage? Maybe I ought to do that. But here there was no ocean. But there is always a way, like in Shakespeare, a pin stuck through one's shirt front, and goodbye Frink. The girl who need not fear marauding homeless from the desert walks upright in consciousness of many pinched nerve possibilities in grizzled, salivating adversary. Death instead by, say, sniffing car exhaust in highway town, perhaps through long, hollow straw. Learned that, she thought, from Japanese. Imbibed placid attitude toward mortality, along with money-making judo. How to kill, how to die. Yang and yin. But that's behind now. This is Protestant land. It was a good thing to see the Nazi rockets go by overhead and not stop, not take any interest of any sort in Cannon City, Colorado, nor in Utah or Wyoming or the eastern part of Nevada, none of the open, empty desert states or pasture states. We have no value, she said to herself. We can live out our tiny lives, if we want to, if it matters to us. From one of the showers, the noise of a door unlocking. A shape, large Miss Davis, finished with her shower, dressed, purse under her arm.
Oh, were you waiting, Mrs. Frink? I'm sorry.
It's all right, Juliana said.
You know, Mrs. Frink, I've gotten so much out of judo, even more than out of Zen. I wanted to tell you.
Slim your hips the Zen way, Juliana said. Lose pounds through painless satori. I'm sorry, Miss Davis, I'm wool gathering. Miss Davis said,
Did they hurt you much?
Who?
The Japs, before you learned to defend yourself.
It was dreadful, Juliana said. You've never been out there on the coast, where they are.
I've never been outside of Colorado, Miss Davis said, her voice fluttering timidly.
It could happen here, Juliana said. They might decide to occupy this region, too.
Not this late.
You never know what they're going to do, Juliana said. They hide their real thoughts.
What did they make you do?
Miss Davis, hugging her purse against her body with both arms, moved closer in the evening darkness to hear.
Everything, Juliana said. Oh, God, I'd fight, Miss Davis said.
Juliana excused herself and walked to the vacant shower. Someone else was approaching it with a towel over her arm. Later, she sat in a booth at Tasty Charlie's Broiled Hamburgers, listlessly reading the menu. The jukebox played some hillbilly tune, steel guitar and emotion-choked moaning. The air was heavy with grease smoke. And yet the place was warm and bright, and it cheered her. The presence of the truck drivers at the counter, the waitress, the big Irish fry cook in his white jacket at the register making change. Seeing her, Charlie approached to wait on her himself. Grinning, he drawled,
Missy want tea now?
Coffee, Juliana said, enduring the fry cook's relentless humor.
Ah, so, Charlie said, nodding.
And the hot steak sandwich with gravy.
Not have bull rat's nest soup, or maybe goat brains fried in olive oil?
A couple of the truck drivers, turning on their stools, grinned along with the gag, too. And in addition, they took pleasure in noticing how attractive she was.
Even lacking the fry cook's kidding, she would have found the truck driver scrutinizing her. The months of active judo had given her unusual muscle tone. She knew how well she held herself and what it did for her figure. "It all has to do with the shoulder muscles," she thought as she met their gaze. "Dancers do it, too. It has nothing to do with size. Send your wives around to the gym and we'll teach them, and you'll be so much more content in life."
"Stay away from her," the fry cook warned the truck drivers with a wink. "She'll throw you on your can."
She said to the younger of the truck drivers, "Where are you in from?"
"Missouri,"
both men said.
"Are you from the United States?"
she asked.
"I am," the older man said. "Philadelphia. Got 3 kids there. The oldest is 11.
"Listen," Juliana said, "is it easy to get a good job back there?"
The younger truck driver said,
"Sure, if you have the right to color skin."
He himself had a dark, brooding face with curly black hair. His expression had become set and bitter.
"He's a wop,"
the older man said.
"Well," Juliana said, "didn't Italy win the war?"
She smiled at the young truck driver, but he did not smile back. Instead, his somber eyes glowed even more intensely, and suddenly he turned away.
"I'm sorry," she thought, but she said nothing. "I can't save you or anybody else from being dark."
She thought of Frank. "I wonder if he's dead yet. Said the wrong thing, spoke out of line. No," she thought, "somehow he likes Japs. Maybe he identifies with them because they're ugly." She had always told Frank that he was ugly. Large pores, big nose. Her own skin was finely knit, unusually so. Did he fall dead without me? A fink is a finch, a form of bird, and they say birds die.
"Are you going back on the road tonight?" she asked the young Italian truck driver.
"Tomorrow."
"If you're not happy in the U.S., why don't you cross over permanently?" she said. "I've been living in the Rockies for a long time, and it isn't so bad. I lived on the coast in San Francisco. They had the skin thing there, too."
Glancing briefly at her as he sat hunched at the counter, the young Italian said,
"Lady, it's bad enough if I have to spend one day or one night in a town like this. Live here? Christ, if I could get any other kind of a job, and not have to be on the road eating my meals in places like this."
Noticing that the fry cook was red, he ceased speaking and began to drink his coffee. The older truck driver said to him,
"Joe, you're a snob."
"You could live in Denver," Juliana said. "It's nicer up there."
"I know you East Americans," she thought. "You like the big time, dreaming your big schemes. This is just the sticks to you, the Rockies. Nothing has happened here since before the war. Retired old people, farmers, the stupid, slow, poor, and all the smart boys have flocked east to New York, crossing the border legally or illegally. Because," she thought, "that's where the money is, the big industrial money, the expansion. German investment has done a lot. It didn't take long for them to build the U.S. back up." The fry cook said in a hoarse, angry voice,
"Buddy, I'm not a Jew lover, but I've seen some of those Jew refugees fleeing your U.S. in 49, and you can have your U.S. If there's a lot of building back there and a lot of loose, easy money, it's because they stole it from those Jews when they kicked them out of New York. That goddamn Nazi Nuremberg law. I lived in Boston when I was a kid, and I got no special use for Jews, but I never thought I'd see that Nazi racial law get passed in the U.S., even if we did lose the war. I was surprised you weren't in the U.S. Armed Forces, getting ready to invade some little South American republic as a front for the Germans, so they can push the Japanese back a little bit more."
Both truck drivers were on their feet, their faces stark. The older man picked up a ketchup bottle from the counter and held it upright by the neck. The fry cook, without turning his back to the two men, reached behind him until his fingers touched one of his meat forks. He brought the fork out and held it. Juliana said,
"Denver is getting one of those heat-resistant runways so the Lufthansa rockets can land there."
None of the 3 men moved or spoke. The other customers sat silently. Finally, the fry cook said,
"One flew over around sundown."
"It wasn't going to Denver," Juliana said. "It was going west, to the coast."
By degrees, the 2 truck drivers reseated themselves. The older man mumbled,
"I always forget. There's a little yellow out here."
The fry cook said,
"No Japs killed Jews in the war or after. No Japs built ovens." Too bad they didn't,
the older truck driver said. But picking up his coffee cup, he resumed eating. Yellow, Juliana thought. Yes, I suppose it's true. We love the Japs out here. Where are you staying? She asked, speaking to the young truck driver, Joe. Overnight.
I don't know, he answered. I just got out of the truck to come in here. I don't like this whole state. Maybe I'll sleep in the truck. The Honeybee Motel isn't too bad, the fry cook said.
Okay, the young truck driver said. Maybe I'll stay there, if they don't mind me being Italian.
He had a definite accent, although he tried to hide it. Watching him, Juliana thought, it's idealism that makes him that bitter, asking too much out of life, always moving on, restless and griped. I'm the same way. I couldn't stay on the West Coast, and eventually I won't be able to stand it here. Weren't the old-timers like that? But, she thought, now the frontier isn't here, it's the other planets. She thought, he and I could sign up for one of those colonizing rocket ships, but the Germans would disbar him because of his skin and me because of my dark hair. Those pale, skinny Nordic SS fairies in those training castles in Bavaria. This guy, Joe whatever, hasn't even got the right expression on his face. He should have that cold but somehow enthusiastic look, as if he believed in nothing and yet somehow had absolute faith. Yes, that's how they are. They're not idealists like Joe and me. They're cynics with utter faith. It's a sort of brain defect, like a lobotomy, that maiming those German psychiatrists do as a poor substitute for psychotherapy. Their trouble, she decided, is with sex. They did something foul with it back in the 30s, and it has gotten worse. Hitler started it with his, what was she, his sister, aunt, niece? And his family was inbred already. His mother and father were cousins. They're all committing incest, going back to the original sin of lusting for their own mothers. That's why they, those elite SS fairies, have that angelic simper, that blonde baby-like innocence. They're saving themselves for Mama. Or for each other. And who is Mama for them, she wondered. The leader, Herr Bormann, who is supposed to be dying? Or the sick one, old Adolf, supposed to be in a sanitarium somewhere, living out his life of senile paresis, syphilis of the brain, dating back to his poor days as a bum in Vienna, long black coat, dirty underwear, flophouses. Obviously it was God's sardonic vengeance, right out of some silent movie. That awful man struck down by an internal filth, the historic plague for man's wickedness. And the horrible part was that the present-day German Empire was a product of that brain. First a political party, then a nation, then half the world. And the Nazis themselves had diagnosed it, identified it. That quack herbal medicine man who had treated Hitler, that Dr. Morell who had dosed Hitler with a patent medicine called Dr. Kuster's anti-gas pills. He had originally been a specialist in venereal disease. The entire world knew it, and yet the leader's gabble was still sacred, still holy writ. The views had infected a civilization by now, and, like evil spores, the blind, blonde Nazi queens were swishing out from Earth to the other planets, spreading the contamination. What you get for incest, madness, blindness, death. Brr, she shook herself. Charlie, she called to the fry cook, you about ready with my order? She felt absolutely alone. Getting to her feet, she walked to the counter and seated herself by the register. No one noticed her except the young Italian truck driver. His dark eyes were fixed on her. Joe, his name was. Joe what? She wondered. Closer to him now, she saw that he was not as young as she had thought. Hard to tell, the intensity all around him disturbed her judgment. Continually he drew his hand through his hair, combing it back with crooked, rigid fingers. There's something special about this man, she thought. He breathes death. It upset her, and yet attracted her. Now the older truck driver inclined his head and whispered to him. Then they both scrutinized her, this time with a look that was not the ordinary male interest.
Miss, the older one said. Both men were quite tense now. Do you know what this is?
He held up a flat white box, not too large.
Yes, Juliana said. Nylon stockings. Synthetic fiber made only by the great cartel in New York, I.G. Farben. Very rare and expensive.
You've got to hand it to the Germans. Monopoly's not a bad idea.
The older truck driver passed the box to his companion, who pushed it with his elbow along the counter toward her.
You have a car?
The young Italian asked her, sipping his coffee. From the kitchen, Charlie appeared. He had her plate.
You could drive me to this place.
The wild, strong eyes still studied her, and she became increasingly nervous and yet increasingly transfixed.
This motel, or wherever I'm supposed to stay tonight. Isn't that so?
Yes, she said. I have a car. An old Studebaker.
The fry cook glanced from her to the young truck driver, and then set her plate before her at the counter. The loudspeaker at the end of the aisle said,
Achtung, mein Damen und Herren!
In his seat, Mr. Baines started, opened his eyes. Through the window to his right he could see, far below, the brown and green of land, and then blue, the Pacific. The rocket, he realized, had begun its long, slow descent. In German first, then Japanese, and at last English, the loudspeaker explained that no one was to smoke or to untie himself from his padded seat. The descent, it explained, would take 8 minutes. The retrojets started then, so suddenly and loudly, shaking the ship so violently that a number of passengers gasped. Mr. Baines smiled, and in the aisle seat across from him, another passenger, a younger man with close-cropped blonde hair, also smiled.
Sie fürchten das,
the young man began, but Mr. Baines said at once in English.
I'm sorry, I don't speak German.
The young German gazed at him questioningly, and so he said the same thing in German.
No German,
the young German said, amazed in accented English.
I am Swedish, Baines said.
You embarked at Tempelhof?
Yes, I was in Germany on business. My business carries me to a number of countries.
Clearly, the young German could not believe that anyone in the modern world, anyone who had international business dealings and rode, could afford to ride, on the latest Lufthansa rocket, could or would not speak German. To Baines he said,
What line are you in, mein Herr?
Plastics, polyesters, resins, ersatz, industrial uses. You see? No consumers' commodities.
Sweden has a plastics industry?
Disbelief.
Yes, a very good one. If you will give me your name, I will have a firm brochure mailed to you.
Mr. Baines brought out his pen and pad.
Never mind. It would be wasted on me. I am an artist, not a commercial man. No offense. Possibly you have seen my work while on the continent. Alex Lotze.
He waited.
Afraid I do not care for modern art, Mr. Baines said. I like the old pre-war cubists and abstractionists. I like a picture to mean something, not merely to represent the ideal.
He turned away.
But that's the task of art,
Lotze said.
To advance the spirituality of man over the sensual. Your abstract art represented a period of spiritual decadence, of spiritual chaos, due to the disintegration of society, the old plutocracy, the Jewish and capitalist millionaires, the international set that supported the decadent art. Those times are over. Art has to go on. It can't stay still.
Baines nodded, gazing out the window.
Have you been to the Pacific before?
Lotze asked.
Several times.
Not I. There is an exhibition in San Francisco of my work, arranged by Dr. Goebel's office, with the Japanese authorities. A cultural exchange to promote understanding and goodwill. We must ease tensions between the East and West, don't you think? We must have more communication, and art can do that.
Baines nodded. Below, beyond the ring of fire from the rocket, the city of San Francisco and the bay could now be seen.
Where does one eat in San Francisco?
Lotze was saying.
I have reservations at the Palace Hotel, but my understanding is that one can find good food in the international section, such as the Chinatown.
True, Baines said.
Our price is high in San Francisco. I am out of pocket for this trip. The ministry is very frugal.
Lotze laughed. Depends on the exchange rate you can manage. I presume you're carrying Reich Bank drafts. I suggest you go to the Bank of Tokyo on Samson Street and exchange there.
Danke, sir,
Lotze said.
I would have done it at the hotel.
The rocket had almost reached the ground. Now Baines could see the airfield itself, hangars, parking lots, the autobahn from the city, the houses. Very lovely view, he thought. Mountains and water, and a few bits of fog drifting in at the Golden Gate.
"What is that enormous structure below?" Lotza asked. "It is half-finished, open at one side. A spaceport? The Nipponese have no spacecraft, I thought."
With a smile, Baines said, "That's Golden Poppy Stadium, the baseball park." Lotza laughed.
"Yes, they love baseball. Incredible. They have begun work on that great structure for a pastime, an idle time-wasting sport."
Interrupting, Baines said, "It is finished. That's its permanent shape. Open on one side. A new architectural design. They are very proud of it."
"It looks," Lotza said, gazing down, "as if it was designed by a Jew."
Baines regarded the man for a time. He felt strongly for a moment the unbalanced quality, the psychotic streak in the German mind. Did Lotza actually mean what he said? Was it a truly spontaneous remark?
"I hope we will see one another later on in San Francisco," Lotza said as the rocket touched the ground. "I will be at loose ends without a countryman to talk to."
"I'm not a countryman of yours," Baines said.
"Oh, yes, that's so. But racially, you're quite close. For all intents and purposes, the same."
Lotza began to stir around in his seat, getting ready to unfasten the elaborate belts. "Am I racially kin to this man?" Baines wondered. "So closely, so that for all intents and purposes, it is the same? Then it is in me, too, the psychotic streak. A psychotic world we live in. The madmen are in power. How long have we known this, faced this, and how many of us do know it? Not Lotza. Perhaps if you know you are insane, then you are not insane. Or you are becoming sane, finally, waking up. I suppose only a few are aware of all this. Isolated persons here and there. But the broad masses, what do they think? All these hundreds of thousands in this city here, do they imagine that they live in a sane world? Or do they guess, glimpse the truth? But, he thought, what does it mean, insane? A legal definition. What do I mean? I feel it, see it, but what is it? He thought, it is something they do, something they are. It is their unconsciousness, their lack of knowledge about others, their not being aware of what they do to others, the destruction they have caused and are causing. No, he thought, that isn't it. I don't know, I sense it, intuit it, but they are purposely cruel. Is that it? No. God, he thought, I can't find it, make it clear. Do they ignore parts of reality? Yes. But it is more. It is their plans. Yes, their plans, the conquering of the planets. Something frenzied and demented, as was their conquering of Africa, and before that, Europe and Asia. Their view. It is cosmic. Not of a man here, a child there, but an abstraction. Race, land, Volk, Land, Blut, air. Not of honorable men, but of air itself, honor. The abstract is real. The actual is invisible to them. Die Gut, but not good men. This good man. It is their sense of space and time. They see through the here, the now, into the vast black deep beyond, the unchanging. And that is fatal to life. Because eventually there will be no life. There was once only the dust particles in space, the hot hydrogen gases, nothing more. And it will come again. This is an interval, ein Augenblick. The cosmic process is hurrying on, crushing life back into the granite and methane. The wheel turns for all life. It is all temporary. And they, these madmen, respond to the granite, the dust, the longing of the inanimate. They want to aid nature. And, he thought, I know why. They want to be the agents, not the victims of history. They identify with God's power and believe they are godlike. That is their basic madness. They are overcome by some archetype. Their egos have expanded psychotically so that they cannot tell where they begin and the Godhead leaves off. It is not hubris, not pride. It is inflation of the ego to its ultimate, confusion between him who worships and that which is worshipped. Man has not eaten God. God has eaten man. What they do not comprehend is man's helplessness. I am weak, small, of no consequence to the universe. It does not notice me. I live on unseen. But why is that bad? Isn't it better that way? Whom the gods notice, they destroy. Be small, and you will escape the jealousy of the great. As he unfastened his own belt, Bane said,
Mr. Lotze, I have never told anyone this. I am a Jew. Do you understand?
Lotze stared at him piteously.
You would not have known, Bane said, because I do not in any physical way appear Jewish. I have had my nose altered, my large, greasy pores made smaller, my skin chemically lightened, the shape of my skull changed. In short, physically I cannot be detected. I can, and have, often walked in the highest circles of Nazi society. No one will ever discover me. And...
He paused, standing close, very close, to Lotze, and speaking in a low voice which only Lotze could hear.
And there are others of us. Do you hear? We did not die. We still exist. We live on unseen.
After a moment, Lotze stuttered.
The security police...
The SD can go over my record, Bane said. You can report me, but I have very high connections. Some of them are Aryan. Some are other Jews in top positions in Berlin. Your report will be discounted, and then, presently, I will report you. And through these same connections, you will find yourself in protective custody.
He smiled, nodded, and walked up the aisle of the ship, away from Lotze, to join the other passengers. Everyone descended the ramp onto the cold, windy field. At the bottom, Baines found himself once more momentarily near Lotze.
In fact, Baines said, walking beside Lotze, I do not like your looks, Mr. Lotze, so I think I will report you anyhow.
He strode on then, leaving Lotze behind. At the far end of the field, at the concourse entrance, a large number of people were waiting. Relatives, friends of passengers, some of them waving, peering, smiling, looking anxious, scanning faces. A heavy-set, middle-aged Japanese man, well-dressed in a British overcoat, pointed Oxfords, bowler, stood a little ahead of the others, with a younger Japanese beside him. On his coat lapel he wore the badge of the ranking Pacific Trade Mission of the Imperial Government. There he is, Baines realized. Mr. N. Tagomi, come personally to meet me. Starting forward, the Japanese called,
Herr Baines, good evening.
His head tilted hesitantly.
Good evening, Mr. Tagomi, Baines said, holding out his hand.
They shook, then bowed. The younger Japanese also bowed, beaming.
Bit cold, sir, on this exposed field, Mr. Tagomi said. We shall begin return trip to downtown city by mission helicopter. Is that so? Or do you need to use the facilities and so forth?
He scrutinized Mr. Baines' face anxiously.
We can start right now, Baines said. I want to check in at my hotel. My baggage, however.
Mr. Kotomichi will attend to that, Mr. Tagomi said. He will follow. You see, sir, at this terminal it takes almost an hour waiting in line to claim baggage, longer than your trip.
Mr. Kotomichi smiled agreeably.
All right, Baines said.
Mr. Tagomi said,
Sir, I have a gift to graft.
I beg your pardon, Baines said. To invite your favorable attitude.
Mr. Tagomi reached into his overcoat pocket and brought out a small box.
Selected from among the finest objets d'art of America available.
He held out the box.
Well, Baines said, thanks.
He accepted the box.
All afternoon assorted officials examined the alternatives, Mr. Tagomi said. This is most authentic of dying old U.S. culture, a rare retained artifact carrying a flavor of bygone halcyon day.
Mr. Baines opened the box. In it lay a Mickey Mouse wristwatch on a pad of black velvet. Was Mr. Tagomi playing a joke on him? He raised his eyes, saw Mr. Tagomi's tense, concerned face. No, it was not a joke.
Thank you very much, Baines said. This is indeed incredible.
Only few, perhaps 10 authentic 1938 Mickey Mouse watches in all world today, Mr. Tagomi said, studying him, drinking in his reaction, his appreciation. No collector known to me has one, sir. They entered the air terminal and together ascended the ramp. Behind them, Mr. Kotomichi said,
Harusami ni niretsutsu yane no tamarikana.
What is that? Mr. Bain said to Mr. Tagomi.
Old poem,
Mr. Tagomi said.
Middle Tokugawa period.
Mr. Kotomichi said,
As the spring rains fall, soaking in them on the roof is a child's rag ball.